You're listening to Face Off, episode 101, recorded December 27th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am Mark Sanborn.
In this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web development, such as, our web technology, actually. Gosh, it's like 100 episodes. I'm losing my memory. We talk about web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship, and everything else in between. As always, if you want to see the show notes for this episode to get some links or anything else that we talk about, go to faceoffshow.com. So, Mark, episode 101. What do you think? Has the 100th episode sunk in yet?
Yeah, it's nice. I only wish the 100th episode didn't fall so close to Christmas and New Year's, because I love doing those podcasts where we talk about, you know, the year in reflection of things we learned and stuff like that. We kind of covered that last episode a little bit, since it was our 100th episode. So we're not going to do like a New Year's one, but we got a special topic for you guys this week. So
we do, actually, but I'm going to cut you off. Let's get into our news and follow ups. The first little follow up that we have is, there was a, it's like a company that makes tools for editing things online, like photos. They have an audio editor and stuff. It's called Aviary. They have a really cool suite of tools. I use them a lot. But they actually just came out with a HTML5 photo editor, which is just really cool, because you can upload a picture and you can do some really basic editing stuff with it, but it's all HTML5, no Flash.
This is nice for people editing in the cloud and, you know.
Yeah, I'm just not
being able to just upload and go.
I just find Flash is chunky. It really gets to me. It kind of gets really, you know, sluggish, and this is all HTML5, so it's, you know, it's super snappy, and, you know, I'm assuming you could probably use it like in Chrome or other WebKit browsers, but, you know, like I upload a picture myself, you can do the sort of goofy filters that are popular right now, like, ooh, it looks like a, what do you call it? The Instagram looks like a, what are the instant Kodak ones?
Kodak. Filters?
No, just what the Kodak, mean? The Kodak.
Polaroid.
Polaroids. You know, you could do the Polaroid filter. Ooh, that looks cool. A toy camera filter. I don't know what toy camera means. I've never seen that before. But
can you actually do some cropping and stuff? And
yeah,
image resizing?
You can crop. You can resize. You can flip it. You can rotate it. You can remove red eye. You can remove blemishes. You can alter the colors. You can change the saturation, brightness, contrast. You can draw on it. You can add text. You can add stickers. Really cool. A lot of stuff you can do all in HTML5. You can also undo and redo, which is super cool.
Yeah, I think there's a big need for something like this because, you know, just like seeing my parents interact online, you know, and going on Craigslist and different things where you're uploading content. A lot of the digital cameras, even in the cell phones, are, you know, 5 megapixels. They make quite large, or they take pictures that are quite large. And you oftentimes you have to resize them, and sometimes, you know, Facebook and stuff will resize pictures for you, but there's sometimes a upload limit, mm-hmm. Especially if you're on a slow connection and whatnot, or if you're uploading lots of pictures, being able to just, you know, add it into here, crop it and resize it is great.
Yeah. I mean, you could do that with the old tools, but I guess it's like, it's just a lot faster and snappier now with HTML5. It's just cool because it's more native and fast. So, check it out. You can get the link to it in our show notes and look for our very own Mark Sanborn in the misconnections section of Craigslist. Let's move on to our geek tool of the week. This is a pretty cool little geek tool. It's called FractureMe.com. I don't know. I didn't know what to call them. It's like Fracture Pictures. But really what it is, it's just you upload your picture to their website. You pick a size and you pay it. And what they do is they send you – it's like a glass panel that they print the picture onto the glass. And then they you know, it's printed to the glass on the back, and then they put a – you know, like a little – like a frame on the back that allows you to hang it to your wall. So it's really cool. It's like a – it's just like a glass square hanging on your wall. There's no frame. You don't have to put a frame on it if you don't want or anything like that. And, you know, like the prices are pretty competitive. And they're talking about how it's really cool because you can't scratch the picture because it's like literally printed to the glass or something. I don't know how they do it, but it looks like it's just on the back of the glass. So you can Windex it as much as you want. You can't hurt it. It's got this little black backing on it with little holes so you can hang it with a nail quickly and easily on your wall. You know, the price is like, if you think about what it takes to get a picture printed really large and then framed and stuff, I think that this is pretty competitive. Like, you can get an 11 by 14, which is the biggest size they offer, for $25. Really robust, looks great on your wall. I was thinking about getting a couple pictures of my wife and getting them made using this, a little 5 by 7 or something to stack up around the house.
I think you should get a Face-Off logo printed.
I was thinking about that, too. I was thinking about my vector portrait because I'm so narcissistic that, you know, I thought I need more pictures of me lying around. like a Face-Off logo or, you know, like the Agile Task logo or something like that. Totally. Hey, you can do cool stuff like that. And it's just, you know, like I don't ever to get a picture and a frame, you know, custom frames are expensive. And this looks cool. It just looks like a nice, good picture framing. I mean, I have a couple pictures that I've purchased at an art show here in Bozeman, and one of them actually is kind of cool. It's kind of like that. It's just glass all the way around, hangs up on the wall, looks really nice. So this is a way to get it done, very professional, looks really nice. I'm kind of excited to get one because the only sort of question is the print quality, and they look to be pretty big sticklers about that, so I'm assuming the print quality will be good. But I'm going to try with a little 5x7, a little $8 one, check it out, you know, hang it up on my wall or put it somewhere. And then we'll see from there. But I saw this and I thought, wow, that's cool. It's like, you know, I don't know. I mean, you go buy frames, you go buy like crappy frames at Target or something and put like a, you know, picture that you have around in it, you know, and like, yeah, that's okay. But this looks like it's really cool, modern and sleek.
Yeah. And some of those frames are like $8. So
yeah, exactly.
And this is kind of cool because it doesn't have the actual frame. It's just the glass. It's more modern and sleek looking.
the funny thing is, if you look at the sizes, how they show you how tall how big the different sizes is a wine glass next to it. If you hover over it, a little wine glass pops up.
Cool.
Yeah, so check it out at FractureMe.com. Let's get into our web apps this week. Our first one, so I'm really probably one of the worst people I know about this. The whole Rickroll thing happened, and that was, you know, it was helped by tiny URLs, URL shorteners, things like Twitter and stuff have made URL shorteners pretty, you know, we're used to seeing them. It's not weird if you get a tiny URL link or something, you don't think about it. But then the whole Rickrolling phenomenon came along. It's like, hey, check out this cool article about, you know, task to do applications. And then you click on it and it's, you know, Rick Astley's video for Never Gonna Give You Up. That all of a sudden made it dangerous to click short URLs. I mean, it used to be life was good. You didn't have to worry about it. Well, I started that up again with Justin Bieber. I've been beeping people, sending them links by Justin Bieber. It's become a thing in our office now where really no one in the office will open a link from me. Like, even if it looks like a clear, you know, not Justin Bieber link, like they're usually pretty skeptical. Well, they can use our first web app, which is called Link Peeler, LinkPeeler, .appspot.com. You just put in the tiny URL and click peel, and it will actually tell you where the link goes so that you don't fall victim to people like me. And the other thing about this one that I really thought was cool was that there is a Chrome extension that you can install so that the extension, you just hover over a link and it'll pop up above it, tell you what the link actually is. You can fall victim to people who might for. Even cooler, though, if you look at the bottom, you can get the link to GitHub to get the source for this app.
No.
Yeah.
You can make your own?
You could. You could change this and do it however you want if you want to make your own. So that, like, if you clicked on it and the link anywhere in the URL, the source URL, it said Justin Bieber, you could have it flash red or do all kinds of crazy things. It's cool. It's open source.
I don't think I'm going to open any links from you anymore. I don't think I need to be beeped.
You do. Everyone does. It's a badge of honor. If you were...
So...
But again...
Looks like this is all just JavaScript. It's a pretty simple technology.
Yeah, really simple, really easy. Just a quick and easy way to check out a shortened link that someone has sent you. So
I like their,
I'm going to have to get more clever.
I like their logo. They got like an onion.
Yeah, exactly. A red peel onion. It. Go ahead and peel that onion. Check it out, linkpeeler.appspot.com. Let's get to our next web app, which is called Monitor. It's MONIITOR.com. Unfortunately, I think a terrible URL. I can't. I have a thing with URLs. If I can't say it smoothly, then you're doomed.
I think domains are getting harder and harder for people to get, and so they're just coming up with the most ridiculous stuff.
Absolutely. And I understand the pain of it because we've been doing apps and it's hard to get URLs. I totally agree, especially if you want a .com, which is very important for SEO, but it's difficult. So I'm not going to bust these people's chops, but I just personally don't like it. But the service that it adds is pretty cool. If you go to Monitor, you can add sites, and what they do is give you a bunch of sort of statistics information about your website in one spot. So I added Faceoff to it, and so I click on Faceoff, and I get the social buzz, which is anyone on Twitter that has mentioned, you know, faceoffshow.com URL. It gives me a little, a little screenshot on the site. It'll tell me the Feedburner subscribers, the Twitter followers, inbound links from Yahoo, Google PageRank, Alexa Rank, Compete Rank, and Quantcast Rank, all in one spot. They'll give you some traffic ranks if you're in Alexa, which you're not, or Compete, which unfortunately due to our traffic we're not. But kind of a cool spot. You know, it's always funny. You always have to find like these goofy web apps to just tell your Google PageRank or use the Google toolbar, which is just silly. And this app will do it for you, along with your subscribers and Twitter followers and all that other cool stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's really simple. You just have to sort of create an account. When you go to add a site, you have to verify that you actually do own the site. So you have to like put a little text file in the root directory that they can find. And then once they know that, you know, it's yours and they can verify it, you're good to go. But cool little site. The thing I'd like to see from this, I'd like to see them do like maybe some Google Analytics integration so you can have some analytics information there too. So you have everything in one spot. But that's a pretty pretty hardcore wish list for a free little awesome tool like this.
Cool. Yeah. I was going to say I've been reading this book about complete. It's like the complete guide to monitoring. It's like 1,000 pages on how to monitor your website, and it talks a lot about like using tools like this to mash up various things like analytics and things to cross reference stuff. Like even simple stuff like uptime to like. Purchases and things can affect or like slow response times and things, or you know, maybe your page rank affects it or whatever. So
yeah, totally.
It's good to have as many mashups as you can of different services for analytics.
Yeah, so, exactly, because if you try to do this by yourself it gets very arduous. You're just like, it's very clunky, you got to check them all and stuff. So these sort of mashups of stats are really cool, so check it out at Monitor, MONIITOR.com. Hey, listening, you person listening to the show, that would make no sense. What am I doing? Do I even know how to record a show these days, Mark? I
you know, after 100 episodes, I would hope you did. Okay.
100 episodes doesn't give you some slack. Hey, if you out there listening to the show, if you have some news, a follow-up, or a web application you want us to look at, or even a geek tool, if you have a geek tool you want us to check out, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can tweet us out. We are at faceoffshow on Twitter. You can email studio@faceoffshow.com. Send us a voicemail. But you can figure out how to get a hold of us by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We'd love to hear from you guys. Let's get into our topic this week, which actually was requested by my good friend, Tyke Vallard, ardent listener to the show. He was listening and he just started using Git. Totally pumped about Git. I think the light bulb sort of clicked on. Like, it's funny when Tyke, he has used, I know Subversion, maybe others, for a long time. And I remember when he and I first started using Subversion, you know, it was mind-blowing. We were totally pumped about it. And then, you know, I think it's one of the things where he started playing around with Git a little bit, and then I think the light bulb just clicked on him as to why Git is so awesome. So he suggested to us, like, you know, I just, you know, listen to your episode. Git is awesome. Why don't you give us some, like, SCM best practices or some tips and tricks that you guys have figured out from using this for so long. So here they are, some SCM best practices that we have been thinking about here at Faceoff Show.
So let's get into it. The number one rule is to actually use it.
Absolutely.
Use source code management, use version control, however you want to say it. You know, and I come from somewhere where you didn't, I didn't have that at first. I started with renaming stuff to .bak for backup or the date .backup or something, yeah, you know. Yeah. You know, because I didn't want to lose my code. And it's just, I mean, even for a single developer, you just got to have it.
So I guess let's, I guess I'll say this. My primary SCM right now is Git. So I guess I'm looking at this from a Git angle. But specifically, especially with our number one rule, any SCM is better than none. If you're not using any and you're a programmer, you really need to brush up your skill set and use some sort of source code management. You know, we dog on Subversion and CVS, but really, if you're using those, that's better than a huge chunk of people out there that aren't.
And I would even say too, if you're kind of more of a designer than a developer, I still think you should check out some version control and stuff for your HTML even.
Totally.
It's just, it'll save you so much time and headache. I know it's a little bit of a pain to learn a new thing. As always, it slows you down a little bit at the beginning, but the benefits will definitely outweigh the cost of learning it. So
I mean, it's a tool. So if you need to, if you know, just like with anything, if you want to continue to be a professional, and if you consider yourself a professional, you should learn new things. And if there is a better tool out there to help you, you need to not be such a curmudgeon about it, and you need to move forward with it. I mean, that's one of the big things I learned with Git. I was kind of dragging my heels with Git. You know, I was like, I use Subversion. You know, I don't see Git as that awesome. And I had enough people that I really trust and you know, confide in to say, no, Git really is different, and you need to try it. And then I did, and it blew my mind. It's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, Subversion was my first introduction to this kind of stuff, and it was just so useful that I was like you. I didn't want to switch to Git.
Yeah, exactly. You think, how could this be any better? Because going from nothing to Subversion was so freaking awesome. You know, there's no way that Git could be that much more awesome. But, it is. And so if you are a professional, you need to learn new tools. You need not be afraid of them. And that's why, you know, hopefully you can use resources like our podcast, you know, us as hosts, tweet us out or anything like that. If you have any questions or anything, I'd love to, you know, try and help you out because it, you know, these tools out there are awesome. You need to learn them, and you'll be, in the end, you'll be much better off learning them.
All right. So the first best practice is commit small and commit often. Here's a funny quote that I found. It's better to have a broken build in your working directory than to have a working build on your broken hard drive. So you want to commit often, you know, in Git, you know, this doesn't mean that you're constantly uploading your code to the central repository in GitHub or your company's server or whatever. It's just commit your code in, make sure you have something in, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be working, if it's in a local branch or something, but you should commit it so where the next time you come back to your computer and you sit down, you can kind of look. You might be able to look in your log, your commit log, and see where you left off and see what's changed since the last time you programmed.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's, again, this is why one of the benefits I like of Git versus Subversion is that I have my local Git repository. I can commit as many times as I want. It doesn't affect any of my coworkers using the repository, you know, or they have their own local copies. It's distributed. So it's okay. I can, you know, I can change two lines and commit that if I want. And that's okay. Now, Subversion, your coworkers might get a little more upset because they'll be like, man, there's commits and I have to pull them all the time. And luckily with, like, you know, Git, you can commit locally as much as you want for every sort of logical change that makes sense and then push them up later without affecting anyone else in your work group.
Yeah, that's definitely the advantage of distributed. See, the problem with, and what made Git so popular was, if you look at Subversion, you're either committing bad code because you're committing a lot, or you're not committing working code, and it's not
getting tracked.
Right, yeah. If you're doing, like, with Subversion, your workflow does tend to be you work on a large chunk and then commit that large chunk, because you don't want to make a ton of smaller commits that really don't affect or just seem, you know, inane to your coworkers. So, like, well, I don't get what that code does. Well, of course you don't get what that code does, because it's one small chunk of the bigger picture. But still, either that way, you know, it's the problem is if you don't commit a lot, then that you can get yourself into a hole where even, you know, SCM can't save you. If you make a change and then you start working on something else and then you just start making massive changes, if you didn't commit every step in between there, you still can't revert. So you still have to go back to square one. So if you're committing often, it's easier to cherry pick stuff out or step back and without losing every little bit of work.
Also, small commits are easy to merge. We'll talk about merging later, but it's important that you're not spending all your time merging stuff. You know, you're being productive and making good code. The other thing is, sometimes people think that their source code management is a backup, and it kind of is, but not really. It's more of a version control. It's more of the code used to look like this, now it looks like this. If you lose your entire directory, it's gone. It's not a backup per se.
Or if your Subversion server dies, it's gone. So yeah, you still need to back everything up.
What I tend to do is use something like Dropbox in conjunction with either GitHub or Bitbucket. And then you see, with the thing with Dropbox is I like a lot of developers have a lot of computers laying around, and all of my computers are synced up to Dropbox. So my code, if I start a folder in Dropbox, Dropbox keeps version history for I think 30 days or something like that. Every computer in my house has a copy because it's synced. As long as it's had access to the internet, it's getting this stuff from Dropbox. So each computer has a copy. There's also an off-site copy at GitHub or Bitbucket. Dropbox. Dropbox has a copy. And then if I use GitHub or Bitbucket, there's also a copy there. Right. So really, you have it backed up in five, six, seven places.
I mean, multiple tiers. You have your local working copy backed up in Dropbox, and the master sort of remote repositories backed up on Bitbucket or GitHub or any other sort of cloud SCM provider, even the ones that, you know, provide Subversion or CVS. So that way, like, any local commits I have and stuff are backed up via Dropbox, you know, and the big master repository is backed up by Bitbucket, GitHub, SourceForge, whoever.
The other nice thing is with Dropbox is, you know, all your computers are synced with the code and ready to go. You don't have to just, you know, you don't have to pull all the time to make sure you're in sync. But you have that extra safety net, I guess, of pushing it up to the central. And it's definitely basically almost a requirement to have a centralized server if you're going to have multiple developers. Unless you're always on a LAN and you can just say, pull my code or something.
I don't know. For me, it's not necessary, but all the extra benefits of things like Bitbucket and GitHub are worth it to me. So,
don't break the code. Each commit should have working condition. And I don't know. I'd like to say, I mean, if you've got a pretty nasty hard feature, I would say you can commit locally different pieces. It may not be perfectly working,
right?
But you don't want to push up to what everybody else is working on something that breaks stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Not going to be productive.
Yeah, and that's sort of, again, the benefit of distributed version control is that you can have your local copy where you can make commits that may not be working code. This also gets into sort of another programming tool that people are using a lot that you should think about, which is continuous integration. So if you're writing tests, if you're doing test-driven development, you're writing your tests and then you're writing the code to make the test pass. And every time you commit or push up, the suite of tests gets ran every time to make sure that all the tests pass. If they don't, everybody gets notified that this is broken. And sort of the whole point of that is that every build is always functioning.
You should always try to include the intention or the why in your commit message instead of just the what. Oftentimes people just say, I added this feature, but they didn't say like why they added it or what it's doing there. Mm-hmm. This is also sometimes applied to writing code comments. Instead of just saying this is here because it does this, this is here, you should say why it's there. Right. A good quote is, if you have nothing to say when you're committing, you probably have nothing to commit.
That's a good one.
Here's one that I oftentimes don't follow my own advice, which is don't comment out code, remove it instead. I just have some trust issues with myself.
But that goes with small commits, right? If you have a specific reason for removing that line because it helps, and if you're doing, again, that's like one of the things where a lot of developers that aren't using these tools, they use undo to the max, like undo, mm-hmm. which is like the whole point of, if you're doing small commits, you don't need to do that, because if you remove that line, it's okay for you to just revert away from removing that line because it's a small commit. You're not reverting all the other code chains you've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I'll, comment out a big block of code, make sure it works. I usually will try to remove it, but sometimes I'm like, I might want to use it. But it's just my own goofiness. I definitely need to get better at doing that.
Yes, because
it's
there. Should.
I mean, it's in my version control, and there's no reason why.
Totally.
The next thing is to reference ticket numbers or bug IDs in your commit messages. And if you can, find a ticket system or bug tracker that will actually tie them together so you can do searches and things. And it also makes it makes it really nice when you're committing your messages, because you can say, this fixes bug 333, comma, blah, blah, blah. Like the one we're using, Redmine, actually will track that and like close the bug for you.
Right. Yeah. So with like Redmine in our commit message, we can say fixes or closes number and give it the ticket number. And when it pulls those changes and gets that commit message, it will actually go and close the ticket for you or add that reference to it. It also has the ability that in a commit message inside the bug tracker, if you can say commit and then give like the git SHA or the revision number and subversion, and it'll reference to that as well. So that, if you go to a particular commit in the SCM part, you're like, oh, well, here's a link back to the ticket. If you go to the ticket, oh, here's a link back to the commit that fixes that or handles that in some way. You can totally do this manually. Redmine makes it really easy to do it automatically for you. Not really easily, I guess I'll say. Once you get it set up, it does it really easily. Getting it set up is kind of a pain, but having that, I mean, it's really nice that, we can just say fixes number, whatever, and then just commit and keep coding. You don't have to go into your bug tracker and close that ticket, because once it gets pulled, it'll close it for you.
This also helps code review. If you've got an email and you're subscribing to your issues, you can click on the commit mess, the commit hash number or whatever, and kind of see the code and check it out. If you have formal code reviews and it makes it nice. Or if let's say you have a bug and you fixed it and a customer says, hey, this bug is bugging me. you can go look at the history of the bug that was fixed, and you can also look at who did it and the code that was submitted to fix it. And
that's corny.
Gives you some insight.
So the next one, is I want to talk about is branch. And again, this is difficult in Subversion because branches are just sort of another file system folder in the repository. This is where like Git and Mercurial make branching super easy and lightweight. So no matter what you're doing, always branch. So like I have my master in Git, which is sort of, I guess if we're using Subversion, it's the trunk. And so from that master, I can just branch and work on an experimental feature, never affecting any of my other coworkers. They never even know that branch exists. And let's say I go off on a crazy tangent and the code I wrote or the feature I was going to do end up not being good. That's okay. I can delete the branch. But or if you're working on a feature, you make a feature branch, you sit and work on your feature, and then you can keep pulling from the master. You keep integrating everyone's changes without affecting anyone else or yourself. Or in general, if you want to go on a complete tangent, like, all right, here we go, complete new feature, complete new application, you can make a branch. Again, the whole point is you can have local and remote branches. So your local branch you can work on whatever you want, however you want, and never have to bug anyone. And then, it's just really easy if your code is going to potentially break. You don't affect your other coworkers. They don't even know. You could just sit and, you know, it's kind of sneakily working on this feature that might break everything, and no one knows.
Yeah, branches are great. I try not to have too many because I just get confused and I forget to pull things. And but it's great for a feature that, like you said, that's going to maybe take a little while and you don't want to be committing changes upstream.
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't want to be committing changes to master if you're doing experimental stuff. So, and I mean, that's kind of a general SCM rule. Everybody knows that, but it's just something that's more difficult to do in Subversion that things like Mercurial and Git make really easy to do.
Yep.
And so on the same token, if you're branching, you need to be merging. So you want to be always, you know, if you have an experimental branch, you can easily merge in your master constantly so that you can get the change that everyone else is pulling from master. Another sort of merge operation with Git and Mercurial is when you pull from the remote. So if you have a remote repository, you're pulling in, that's a merge. So same thing, you want to be pulling from the remote often, getting your coworkers' changes, and then merging them into your various branches or just merging them locally as much as possible, because again, you don't want to end up with this big, huge feature that you've been working on forever and then go to merge and have all kinds of, you know, conflicts and problems because you haven't been merging this whole time.
Yep. That's often the step I always forget. And then my branches, when I do try to merge, it's like a bajillion conflicts because I haven't merged in a while. Yeah. And
I mean, Git and Mercurial have very, very smart merging algorithms. So they, I would say I've noticed they greatly reduce the number of conflicts. I never know how to conflicts. Say that. Conflicts. it minimizes the number of conflicts in general. So Subversion, I always had a lot more conflicts than Git and Mercurial, but you still run into them if you're not merging constantly. Because what you do is you sort of minimize. You're merging, and if there's a conflict, then you just settle that right there. And the SCM has a more clear idea of how your code is changing or moving with the master branch or any other branch.
You shouldn't really go home for the day, and especially like not over the weekend or go on vacation when you have stuff that's not committed. You know, sometimes what I'll do every once in a while, this happens to me where I forget to close out for the day, I forget to commit and all that, and I come back and I without even checking, you know, the Git status or, you know, HG status, I just start working on a new feature, and then I go to commit that, and it's like all these other files that were changed that I did before. Yeah. And it's like, wait a minute, what is this stuff? And it just helps to remember, kind of keep a bookmark of where you were in your code. You can, you know, do a Git log and see what you last committed, see what the diff is, see what you changed. And for that other reason that I described, if you start your day off and you don't do a Git status and you start changing things, what if you broke something the day before and you then you would have to revert the stuff and lose a few things.
Well, and in general, things like Git likes a clean status. So if you have a dirty status, meaning you have uncommitted changes, it's not that it likes, it tries to be more flexible about it. So like there's times where I'm working in a branch and I start changing stuff. Like I'm in master, let's say, and I start changing stuff, and then but I'm not committing, I'm just changing, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh man, this should be in a new branch because I don't want to break the master. If they're not committed, I can switch branches right then, and it'll bring my uncommitted changes with me, which is really handy. So, like, because you can switch branches mid-change when you're like, oh, this should be in a new branch. But in general, like, a lot of times where people get in trouble with Git is where if they have a dirty status. So usually if you commit everything and you can say Git status and it's clean, then you can switch branches and do whatever without any sort of weird goofiness. A lot of people run into that with, like, Git and Mercurial when they – or maybe not Mercurial because you can't have unstate. I don't know. But anyways, just in general, they like a clean state. They like everything to be committed and clean so it can move branches easily. Especially if you're a beginner, that's something you'll find you need to do a lot. And so this is kind of it. You can – sort of limit that problem by using something like Dropbox. Like, I don't commit every day before I go home because I know Dropbox will sync and I'll have my changes at home. But that's, you know, that's me being bad. I should not do that.
Yeah, I mean, another example that I just thought of is every once in a while, I don't know what it is, but like the Rails project will have like a plugin change of a like a file type change. Maybe sometimes it's Dropbox or something.
I think it's Dropbox.
Like swap files and some weird stuff. And I usually just do like git reset hard.
Yeah.
But if I didn't commit my changes from the day before, I could potentially wipe out my changes. So it's kind of one of those things that it's just a best practice to commit out and close out for the day. And definitely check your status before you start working.
Well, and in general, too, I'm really bad about remembering what I was going to do. So, like, if you ask me on Friday when I'm working on something, I'm like, yeah, I'll remember by Monday that I was changing this so that this feature so that it would act this way. No duh. And then Monday, like, I'll come in and I'll be, like, diffing and I'll be like, what was I doing? You know, what crazy tangent was I on? And so if I commit and get a good commit message on that before I head out, I have more of a clue as to what was happening.
Don't add generated files to the repository. This is kind of like the Dropbox, random stuff. If you can prevent that, it's best. Another example is document. So like we use Sphinx for Agile Tasks to generate our documentation. We write our documentation in kind of a wiki-like markup and we build it. It actually builds HTML. There's no sense for us to put that in the source code management because it's going to be changing all the time and it's just going to be causing merge conflicts and stuff. So things that get generated like documentation, you can have your source files for your documentation in source code management, but you don't want to have those, the actual build in there. And also if you're compiling, you probably don't want to have it in there as well.
Right.
Like if your code is compiled.
Well, and I mean, another thing on the subject of not committing things that you shouldn't, make sure you don't commit like production parameters like URLs, usernames, and passwords into it, because everyone will have access to it and it's kind of a security risk. So like with Rails, it's kind of generally accepted that you don't put your database.yml in there, because first of all, that changes from environment to environment. So like I like to use SQLite 3 for my development DB in Rails. You might actually like to use MySQL. So if we committed the database YML, it's like everyone is dictating, which database and whatnot. And so you don't need that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I can't remember the project I was looking at, but just the other day I was kind of browsing through some old revisions in the code. And I don't remember why, but I found some credentials that were in there that he got, then he then reverted and got rid of. But since the source code management was still there, so it's just totally. It's one of those things you want to just be careful and not get it in your version control, because once it's in there, it's probably going to be there forever unless you do some crazy.
Yeah, I think like stuff. Git has a mutable history, which means you can change it. Mercurial, on the other hand, this is one thing I kind of like about Mercurial that I don't really like about Git as much, is that it is the history is immutable. It is written in stone, and you can't, barring deleting your local repository and rechecking it out, it's like, or deleting the repository in general, it is there forever.
So, I mean, if you can make your code so you can send a config file or something, and then just keep that config file not in the version control. And then the other cool tip is SCM can be used not just for code, but also for server configs and documentation. Typically, it has to be a distributed and not a centralized like SVN to do this to make it worthwhile, I guess, because you'd have to set up a server just for your config, config
files. Totally.
It would be worth it, but for Git, it's so awesome. You just go into your SSH config, you go in there and say git init, git add all or whatever. And if somebody goes in there and they don't know what they're doing and they just start mucking around, you can just revert their changes.
Mm-hmm. Or tripwire it. Like if you just git init the folder and all of a sudden you go in and you do a git status and it's, something's changed, you're like, huh, who's changing? I agree. It's especially the distributed stuff makes it really easy to do that. You just go in a folder and edit it. It's awesome. But another thing, I mean, just in general, talking about SCM, it makes sure everyone in your team is up to speed on it, because there's nothing worse than someone on your team who doesn't know how to use it, because it is such a powerful tool and it is such a useful tool. So be really generous about helping them if they have questions or making sure everyone's on the same page, because like if you go into an office and you're a subversion guy and everyone's using Git, it will really, really, really benefit you to come up to speed. And especially if you have someone in your office that doesn't know SCM and they come along, get them using it, help them understand why it's so awesome and why it's so useful. And then everyone in the office can be productive and happy just the way they should be.
Yeah, I think it's important to bring up you know, bring everybody up to speed, because it'll benefit you in the long run, and everyone else, because they won't be committing bad commit messages and or committing humongous chunks of code. Just
right. You know. Or if they don't fully understand it, oftentimes they are a lot less productive because they'll be working on something and they're like, oh man, I totally screwed up my Git repo. I mean, I've done this when I was learning Git, and it's like, I don't know what to do, so I'm just going to delete the whole thing and start over. And you lost all that work. Whereas, you know, if you have a Git whiz or someone in your office or something, you can ask them like, hey, I think this is what I did. How do I fix it? You know, I have a couple guys in my office who are amazing with Git. So at the time, I didn't lean on them, but after a while, I realized that I'm much better off asking them to help me figure it out and learn the tool properly rather than starting over all over again. So, again, though, I want to reiterate, number one rule with SEM is that you need to be using it. Always, it's a great tool. And if you're a programmer, I would say, I think it's an essential tool. I recently got, oh, hey, here's the news of follow-up. My coworkers for Christmas gave me an awesome, awesome, awesome Christmas present. They gave me like a getting started with Arduino kit. If you don't know what Arduino is, it's like a small microcontroller board with like its own sort of really easy to use language and compiler and IDE. But this is what's funny is the IDE is it's a GUI IDE, and I keep thinking like all the time, like, man, I need to be committing my Arduino code. And the you know, the IDE's GUI doesn't really support that easily, and I'm like, oh, I feel dirty because I'm writing code that's not an SEM, and I'm a rebel. So, but check it out. We'll put a link to Arduino in the thing. Thank you to my coworkers who may be listening, because that is an awesome present, and that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. If you haven't done so already, please do. And then we can be delivered to your friendly podcatching application weekly without any work. You can also leave feedback for the show, as we mentioned earlier, by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We are at faceoffshow on Twitter. Email studio@faceoffshow.com. We'd love to hear from you guys and appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. You guys make the 100 episodes worth it by helping us out and talking with us. So send us some tweets and some emails. We'd love to hear from you guys. Thank you for listening, and we will see you guys next week.